Hello, welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Coming up, what's it like to be an asylum seeker living in the community but forbidden from working? Also, plea bargains. Can a prosecutor ever suggest a specific prison sentence to a judge? First, the extraordinary case of Wilcox and Wilcox, a legal fight over a pastoral holding in Walgett in western New South Wales. Professor Prue Vines is based at the University of New South Wales. She's one of the country's leading experts on wills and succession law. She says last week's Supreme Court decision involved a long-running battle between a mother and her son, and it's ripped the family completely asunder.
It was one of those sad cases where a family's really torn apart by their feelings about the need to inherit an estate. This is a country case. There was a farm, which was really a series of properties. And the grandsons have brought an action against challenging the will of the testator, who was their grandfather. And I think one of the most striking things is that they sought to oust their mother, who had actually always lived on the property and was the one who was running the property.
Prue Vines, the first lines of this decision are pretty extraordinary. Can you just read out the first line or two?
"This is a sorry case," says the judge, "brought by two adult grandsons, seeking orders that provision be made for them out of their grandfather's estate."
How unusual is that kind of frank, clear legal language?
It's very unusual for judges to make. They do occasionally make comments about the character or what they think of the merits of the case, but it's not very usual. Usually they try very hard to simply set out the facts and then your own conclusions can be drawn. One of the things that's interesting about this case, that this is grandsons for a grandfather and they're adults. The legislation actually puts grandchildren in a relatively secondary position. A grandchild is supposed to do more than just be a grandchild before they can claim under family provision.
Now, I think there were originally two claims and one was settled, and the one which was decided last week was the one involving Robert Wilcox, age 46. Clearly, Justice Pembroke didn't think much of Robert Wilcox's claim. He said his claim seemed to be based on, quote, "a highly developed and unhealthy sense of entitlement." What was Robert Wilcox's legal argument to try and revisit the will of his granddad?
Robert Wilcox said that his grandfather had often said, "Oh, you'll work this farm when after I've gone, or you'll manage this," or if they talked about the future, say, "Oh, well, that'll be your problem later on." So his argument was that the grandfather basically made some kind of express promise that the grandsons would inherit the farm, when actually the evidence shows that all along the grandfather had wills which left the property to his daughter first, and then the grandfather had assumed that the daughter would then pass it on to the sons.
And what did the judge say about the opportunities Robert Wilcox had been given in life and how he had lived his life?
Well, he thought that Robert Wilcox had been given a great many opportunities. His grandfather sent him to King's, an elite private school in Sydney, and he went there as a boarder. He had also funded him to go to agricultural college and so on. But the plaintiff doesn't appear to have been on the property for the last 10 years or so before his grandfather died. The judge really thought that he hadn't made much effort in relation to making his life work, and that he'd been too certain that he was going to get an inheritance, and therefore he hadn't bothered very much.
He did sort of run some small businesses, but I think he's currently on unemployment benefits. And the judge said,
yes,
quote, "his delusional insistence on his entitlement to own and operate his grandfather's pastoral properties has, I suspect, operated as a self-imposed impediment to his advancement in life."
Yes, those are strong words, and you know, who knows whether they're correct or not. But I think there's quite a lot of evidence in the case that suggests that the plaintiff was fairly unrealistic, not just in relation to his view about whether he'd been promised the farm, but also in his view of what the farm would give him as an income, so that he thought he would get an income from the farm of around $200,000, when it was quite clear that the farm was actually not all that viable. Certainly the expert witness didn't think the farm was all that viable. And his mother, who was living on the farm, appeared to be only drawing around $1,000 a month from the farm, which is a great deal less than Wilcox appears to have thought.
The judge made the point that there's often a misconception out there about the role of these family provision claims. What can a judge do when somebody comes into court and says, "I want to revisit the will"?
Yes, well, I think that's important. A judge can't say, gee, this isn't fair, I think I'll make this will in a fair way. What the judge has to do is go through the terms of the legislation. And so the terms of the legislation say that the judge has to consider whether there is adequate provision, whether a wise and just testator would have made provision for this particular person. And so whether that provision is adequate and proper for their maintenance, education and advancement in life. The fact that the grandfather had already contributed a great deal doesn't mean that there's necessarily a continuing need to give more to the grandchildren under this.
Perhaps surprisingly, given all the stinging barbs which were made by the judge, he does give Robert Wilcox some money. Why does he do that?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is that he thought that the grandfather, being a wise and just testator, would make some limited provision, especially for a grandson who had significant debts. In this case, there was quite a large debt to the tax office. So he was given an amount to pay off that debt.
About $100,000, I think.
Yeah. And then, $107,000. And then he was also given a small amount to sort of help him get on his feet for about 7 years. So $40,000 a year to give him a chance to get himself something that would work for him. But again, because of the difficult state of rural property, I mean, at the moment, obviously we're talking about farmers getting drought benefits and so on, the judge took that into account and deferred the paying of this amount for 2 years to allow hopefully the drought will be over and better times will be coming.
Prue Vines, what were the circumstances? What were the current circumstances of Robert Wilcox?
Well, the court thought that they weren't desperate, but they were certainly modest. He was living in shared accommodation in Darling Point. That doesn't actually give us, although Darling Point is a prosperous suburb of Sydney, the fact that it's shared accommodation suggests a certain lack of security. He had owned several businesses, none of which seemed to have gone all that well, but he hadn't been made bankrupt. He had some skills and expertise and so on, but he didn't seem to feel that he could earn the amounts he thought that he couldn't make the amounts earning that he could if he was running the family agricultural business.
So Robert Wilcox was pretty lucky.
I think he's extraordinarily lucky. Looking at the range of cases and where people have been refused anything at all, I think despite the negative things the judge has said about him, he's actually done very well out of this jurisdiction.
He said, quote, his delusional insistence on his entitlement to own and operate his grandfather's pastoral properties has, I suspect, operated as a self-imposed impediment to his advancement in life. Mm. Almost Shakespearean.
It is almost Shakespearean, and certainly it suggests that some of the cases we've seen in family provision in the past where very wealthy people have left relatively small amounts to their children and grandchildren because they felt that it leaving them too much might actually interfere with their ability to work. Maybe there's something in it in some cases.
Professor Prue Vines, based at the University of New South Wales. Now to plea bargains. If an accused and prosecutors sit down and thrash out a plea bargain agreement, should prosecutors be able to recommend a specific prison sentence to the judge? Well, up until now, the practice has varied around the country, but a decision of the High Court now makes it crystal clear that prosecutors can never suggest a specific prison term. Sam Norton's a partner with Rob Starry Lawyers, and he's also the co-chair of the Law Institute of Victoria's Criminal Law Section. He says the High Court decision involved Pasquale Barbaro and Saverio Zirilli, the pair who were behind the world's biggest seizure of the drug ecstasy, a whopping 4.4 tonnes of the stuff.
They were two men who were alleged by the federal police to have been involved in the large-scale importation of primarily ecstasy.
Back in 2007, there was a shipment of drugs worth a whopping $122 million, which was discovered inside imported cans of tinned tomatoes. It was a haul of something like 15 million MDMA pills or ecstasy pills.
Yes.
And it was, I think, the biggest in Australia's history and one of the biggest in the world.
Yes. It was obviously a large police operation. It was a large prosecution once the matter got to court. It was a genuinely big case.
Arrests in four states over a huge seizure of ecstasy. Federal police have arrested 16 people across Australia in connection with what they say is the world's largest seizure of the drug ecstasy.
Police made the arrests in four states this morning as part of a year-long investigation into an international drug syndicate.
So the pair pleaded guilty. What do we know about the plea negotiations?
There was a massive amount of material in the case, huge amounts of telephone intercepts and that type of thing. So the negotiations had spanned for a very long period of time. Now, I should make clear, I didn't act for either of these two men, and nor did the firm that I represent. There is a larger operation. There are other people that have been charged, and we have had an involvement with that larger operation, so I don't wish to say too much about those matters. But the negotiations in respect to the two men that ultimately ended up in the High Court spanned over a very long period of time, involved all sorts of backwardsing and forwardsing, all sorts of drilling down into the materials and what in fact it meant, what the roles were of the men, the extent of the importation, what they knew of it, all that sort of thing.
As I understand it, the pair agreed to plead guilty to some of the big major charges, and in return, the prosecution agreed to recommend certain jail sentences.
As part of the discussions that led to the ultimate resolution, the prosecution indicated that this is what we will say they should get on penalty.
For Barbaro, they agreed to a head sentence of between 32 and 37 years with a non-parole period of 24 to 28 years. And for Zirilli, a head sentence of 21 to 25 with a non-parole period of 16 to 19 years. Now, that's what was agreed between the prosecution and these accused. When it got to the Supreme Court of Victoria for the sentencing hearing, what did Justice Betty King say when the prosecution informed the court that they wanted to recommend a sentence?
Well, at the time, the practice in place was the prosecution could inform the sentencing judge if the judge asked them to. And consistent with her practice in other cases, Justice King did not ask and did not wish to be informed. When it was raised that they'd come to this position and they had a position to inform her of, she indicated very clearly that she didn't wish to hear it.
In colloquial terms, she said, back off, I'm not interested in hearing what you have to say. It's my job as a judge to work out an appropriate sentence.
Indeed.
So at that point, do you know what sentences she actually gave the pair?
Barbara got life sentence with a non-parole period of 30 years and Zirilli got a non-parole period of 18 years.
So they were above what had been a kind of agreed to in the plea bargaining with the prosecution. Now, the pair's lawyers then appealed to the High Court saying, this is unfair, we should have had the opportunity, or the prosecution should have had the opportunity to put this the deal before the judge. What did the High Court say?
The High Court made it very clear that it's the province of the sentencing judge and that the opinions of the prosecution as to the appropriate penalty are in effect irrelevant. The prosecution can make submissions as to matters relevant to the sentence, but not as to what the sentence in fact ought to be.
So up until this point, Victorian prosecutors could always give a judge a sentencing range if the judge asked for it, but the High Court said there's no reason to even do that.
Well, I should say, firstly, that the type of agreement that was reached in this particular case was at the time very rare. Now it doesn't happen at all, and they ordinarily arose in the type of context that this case found itself in, and that is really extensive negotiations, really lengthy processes that are being involved.
Big cases.
Big cases. The prospect of months of court time being taken up, the prospect of massive expense being incurred by the public purse. They're the type of cases that sees both of the parties very much ensconced in the proceedings and then being able to reach these types of agreements.
This decision makes now Victoria consistent with everywhere else around the country, I understand, but doesn't make plea negotiations more difficult in these big cases, because at the end of the day, prosecutors no longer can offer the carrot of a recommended lower sentence as an incentive. Does that make things more complicated?
Look, the process has been, it's evolved over a period of time. It used to be that the prosecution would simply say whether it's jail or not. And obviously when you're getting involved in cases where people are getting life sentences or anything in that vicinity, they're obviously going to get jail anyhow, so that recommendation doesn't make much of an impact. Then we developed to the stage where a Crown range could be given if requested, but all it was a range, and it wasn't unusual at all for judges to sentence outside that range, whether it be above or below. It would be a rare case where the resolution would be contingent upon a particular outcome. And of course, even if you get the agreement from the prosecution that this is what you're going to ask for, or they are going to ask for, there is no guarantee to the client in any event. So it didn't form an enormous part of plea negotiations. It's not a situation like plea bargaining that you might see on TV from American trials and things of that type, where they go together and come to the court and say, this is worth 7 years, this is what the person should get. None of that ever happened here. And so it's important that the listeners don't misunderstand the way in which these things have unfolded.
But clearly it was something which was considered useful by defence lawyers, or at least Barbara Onzarilli's lawyers.
Yeah. Look, there are individual cases where, as a result of the negotiations, you'll get to a position where you think, look, that's an appropriate range. That's the type of sentence that we think the client should get.
So without this potential way forward on the table, what bargaining chips does the prosecution have if they don't have this one?
The bargaining chips for the prosecution haven't really changed, in my view. There's a declaration that the court has to make as to the discount that's applicable to the plea of guilty, and the prosecution have then got the capacity to withdraw charges or amend charges to present the case in a slightly more favourable way in some level of compromise. So those things still exist, have existed for some time, and will continue to exist.
Let's talk more generally about negotiations. When you have a guilty plea, the defence and prosecution then go on to provide the court with an agreed statement of facts, because then the court's not going to hear the evidence from the individual witnesses, to help the judge work out the appropriate sentence. Is there a lot of negotiation about what goes into that agreed statement of facts, and can that help to help steer a judge in terms of the likely sentencing outcome?
Yes, it certainly can, and there are negotiations that go into that process. But not all cases are dealt with by way of an agreed statement of facts, and in fact, not that many of them are.
You're based in Victoria. There was a case last year in New South Wales, and I'm not expecting you to know in great detail about it. It was a Nathan William Forrest. He pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of a four-year-old Bailey Constable, the son of Forrest's de facto partner. He was sentenced to 6 years non-parole. What was interesting was A Current Affair did a very powerful story looking at the circumstances of the death, and there was a lot of criticism of the judge following the airing of this quite involved story. I think she even received death threats. But at that point, the Chief Justice of New South Wales wrote to A Current Affair saying, look, amongst other things, there's a lot of information in the program that wasn't actually before the judge because it wasn't put in the agreed statement of facts. So it seems that case seems to imply that there can sometimes be situations where the judge doesn't have all the information before them.
Look, I'm not in a position to comment at all on that case. What I can say is that summaries are often negotiated, as you've already touched upon, and witnesses, be they victims or eyewitnesses, won't always have their version of events faithfully recorded in that summary. Now, there's a variety of evidence to take into consideration, and so the evidence is considered and negotiated upon, discussed in formulating these statements of fact. It's not a situation where every single piece of evidence can be reflected in the summaries. Often the evidence is conflicting. So
it could potentially not even be admissible.
Absolutely. There's a whole variety of steps that are gone through before the material is presented to the court, and material which is either irrelevant or is just simply in relation to matters either predate or are unrelated to the offence are often left out. From time to time, victims or indeed other witnesses are going to be of the view that views that they've expressed should have been included in those summaries. That's unfortunately an unavoidable part of the process.
Of course, victims don't form any part of plea bargains, do they? They might be consulted by the prosecutors, but they, at the end of the day, they have no veto.
They don't have a power of veto, no. They are consulted, though, and they're obviously entitled to make victim impact statements. They're entitled to present those victim impact statements by attending court, reading them out, getting into the witness box, things of that type.
And they will always go before the judge, irrespective of a plea bargain.
Yes.
Sam Norton, partner with Rob Starry Lawyers and also co-chair of the Law Institute of Victoria's Criminal Law Section. You're listening to The Law Report on RN, or perhaps you're listening to a podcast or audio on demand. Both are available from the RN website at abc.net.au/RN. The recent death of asylum seeker Reza Barati on Manus Island has focused attention on asylum seekers who've been deflected offshore. Over the last few years, the door has progressively closed on boat arrivals. The Centre for Human Rights Education at Curtin University in Perth has just released a report which focuses on a much luckier group, asylum seekers who arrived before the door was completely shut. They are now living in the Australian community awaiting the determination of their refugee claim. But they can't work. Here's Ahmad from Iraq, who arrived in Australia 18 months ago.
Sometimes I'm going to class English. Sometimes I'm going gym. Sometimes I'm going to shopping. I just have a look, you know. Library, I'm going to library. No way, that's it. Go to a friend. Sometimes I'm going to park, have a look. That's it. Don't have anything because my money is little bit, 500 to after 2 weeks. That's 500 for my rent, my food, my phone.
Do you live in an apartment or do you live in a house?
No, apartment by myself.
And how much rent do you pay?
I pay $170 every week.
So that leaves you, what, less than $100 a week for everything else?
Yeah.
Is it very frustrating not being able to work?
I wish I work. I wish because, you listen, I talk to immigration. I don't need any money for you. I don't need anything. Just give me a permanent visa. I need to work.
Curtin University's Dr. Carolyn Flay says Ahmad is one of a group of more than 20,000 who are not allowed to work. They live a twilight, marginal existence of enforced idleness.
There's many now that have been living for well over a year in the community in situations of great financial hardship. They're only entitled to receive 89% of a Centrelink payment, which equates to roughly around $220 a week. But one of the biggest issues that we found with people is that because they had not been allowed to work, there was also this terribly sort of long days where all they could do is worry about everything else that was worrying them, in particular what was going to happen to them, what was going to happen to their families, many of whom were left behind, and I would imagine a large proportion of those families would be in pretty dangerous conditions.
What did asylum seekers tell you about how they deal with living on these 89% of a Centrelink payment?
Well, it was with great difficulty. I mean, a lot of people were living in overcrowded conditions. Finding affordable housing was one of the significant difficulties for people. Many of the men who were here on their own were living in, you know, up to sort of seven in a house, sharing bedrooms. Many of them were finding it hard to make their rental payments each week. They were finding it very hard to buy enough food.
The report talks about one person living without heating or electricity through a Melbourne winter.
Yes, yeah, that was a family actually, a family with three young children who were in Melbourne. And if it wasn't for the intervention of a refugee advocate, they would have been in that situation a lot longer. They had to accept a house I visited that house. It was pretty run down. The backyard was, you know, completely unsafe for children. But it also means that people are really vulnerable and in terms of being ripping off by people who in the private rental market, and we certainly met some who were paying an enormous amount of rent for sharing a room in a very crowded house, and clearly the house didn't sound like it was a great place to live.
Do you find that people just spend their days watching television? I mean, is that what people do?
Some were doing that. It was interesting, you know, we talked a lot about that, you know, how are you getting through the day? A lot of people will sleep as late as they can and stay up all night. A lot of people were having trouble sleeping. Insomnia was a huge issue, and that's very common, you know, when people are really distressed. One man spoke to us about how he would go to the local library. He would, most days, he would read. He would participate in anything that was offered there. They have some fairly limited English language classes. I mean, that's the other thing for this group. They're denied the access to proper organised English classes, so that's another huge barrier for them. You know, there are communities in all of the major cities where a lot of asylum seekers tend to live, and if you go there, you can see people, you know, walking around and fairly aimlessly trying to fill the day. It's a very long day. And, we've got particular concerns about many of the people that we met and how they're going to cope as this situation continues. And it's going to continue for a long time. The department is so behind in the processing that it's going to take years to get through all of those people.
Tell me, give me some of the sense of what the people told you about the impact of not being able to work.
A number of people talked about the torture that they'd experienced in their own countries. Someone from Sri Lanka, for example, was talking about how he was tortured in his own country. And he said that in my country, they truly actually torture people. Here they torture people in the mind. And so he felt that he was continuing to be persecuted, continuing to be tortured here because of the situation that has been forced upon him while he's been here.
Do people tell you that life on the outside is not that different from life in detention? How do people talk about that?
That's a really interesting question, actually. I've been a visitor of detention centres for a number of years, and I've visited people who have been in detention a long time, and I've witnessed what happens to them. And it's that, you know, you're literally watching people disintegrate when they've been in detention, particularly when they're there for well over a year. There was a couple of people who I interviewed in Melbourne. They had been in the community in this situation the longest of the people we interviewed. At that stage, they had been here for 8 or 9 months. And I felt I was talking to someone who was still in detention. He had the same, one in particular, had the same terrible distress, terrible fear, and, was visibly upset and visibly shaken by what was going on. And it seemed to me that we were placing people in the same mental state as if they were locked up. Now, on the other hand, some of the others we interviewed, some who hadn't been in the community all that long, made the observation that, you know, they realised when they got out of detention, you know, there was that sort of great moment of feeling free. But both of these in particular said, we realised pretty quickly, of course, how difficult it is to live in the community with so little money and so little support. And one of them said, I feel like actually I would be better off in detention. I know I've got a roof over my head and I know I'll have food. So I think we found that quite sad that we're allowing people to be in our community where some of them feel that maybe it would be better to be locked up if I'm going to get a bit of food and a roof over my head, as damaging as detention is.
Dr. Caroline Flay, based at the Centre for Human Rights Education at Curtin University. That's the Law Report for this week. Do visit us online at abc.net.au/rn. There you can find podcasts, audio on demand and program transcripts. And you'll also find a range of links to documents and organisations discussed in the program. You can also catch The Law Report as a podcast on iTunes. And you can also leave a comment or keep in touch via Twitter. The show's handle is @LawReportRN. Or my personal handle is @Damien_Carrick. That's the show for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to audio engineer this week, Mark Veer. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks for your company.